recent comeback of the retail real estate sector surprised many casual observers and even some CRE professionals. But Josh Pogue wasn't one of them. As he told me recently, the fact that brick and mortar has come back into favor with retailers, institutional investors, and shoppers isn't surprising. The only question was timing. The pendulum, he said, always swings back. And he's in a good position to know. As the CEO of Pogue Development Group, Josh Pogue is the second generation leader of a company whose predecessor firm was founded by two industry innovators. Back in the 1980s, Josh's dad, Dan Pogue, along with his partner Terry McEwen, developed the nation's first purpose-built lifestyle center. Fast forward to today, and Pogue Development is planning what's believed to be the only new lifestyle center underway in the U.S. Hi, and welcome back to Investment Matters. I'm Paul Rosta, Executive Editor at CPE. In this episode, you'll hear about the journey Josh Pogue never expected, from majoring in chemical engineering at Princeton to running a major investment and development firm. He addresses the forces driving brick-and-mortar retail's comeback and what's next for the open-air lifestyle center. And he tells the inside story of forging a milestone partnership that's paving the way for the company's next phase. Take a listen. Josh Pogue, welcome to Investment Matters. It's really nice to have you here today as our guest.
Appreciate it, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
So let's talk a little bit about the big picture of retail, which is your sweet spot, of course. For a while now, we've been hearing that the retail sector is enjoying a really nice revival. It's an investor favorite again. People are flocking back to centers and there's new development going on. Does this surprise you as much as it seems to be surprising a lot of other people these days? I mean, there was a time not too many years ago when the mantra was, brick and mortar retail is dead and that's the end of it. But are you as surprised as some other folks probably are right now?
I'm not. I've been in the business for 26 years. And so for the first, 8, 9 years of my career was when retail was a darling and lifestyle centers were exploding. And when the great financial crisis hit in 2008, I remember talking to a friend of mine and he had one of the greatest quotes that I still use today. He said, Josh, we weren't as smart as they thought we were a year ago, but we're not as dumb as they think we are now. And yeah. The pendulum always swings. And so that's where retail has had its struggles with e-commerce taking a portion of retail sales over the last decade. But we even saw that retail start to come back pre-COVID, but then COVID obviously threw a monkey wrench in everything. But it's now settling back out. So the fact that retail is coming back in favor is not really surprising. I guess the timing is always the question mark, is when is the pendulum going to swing? But it always swings.
Josh, could you give us a couple of things to watch for this year? What do you expect are the main trends that will drive retail real estate in 2024 or even beyond if you want to go that far?
Yeah. Well, and so the way I look at it is kind of twofold. I mean, first of all, in the retail sector itself, it's just taking a look at the health of the tenants. And so while tenant sales may not have exploded last year like they had over the past few years because of inflation and because of COVID, their profitability has been up because they are operating more efficiently due to supply chain issues and inventory and everything like that. So when you look back at the retailers and their earnings reports, they may not be exploding in sales, but their profitability is really strong. And so with profitability, they're looking for ways to expand. And so that's first and foremost is to watch the profitability of the retailers. But then number two is the supply and demand of money. And this gets to where in the past decade, industrial and multifamily have been the hot sectors, and retail has been far down that list. I mean, maybe even behind office. Well, that's changing. I mean, with the slowdown in e-commerce sales, there's not as much industrial need. There is still growth, but it's not nearly what it has been in the past. Multifamily is going through its correction with the oversupply and reduction in rents. And office, as we know, with the work for home conversations, has really taken a hit on the chin. And so suddenly, the stability and cash flow that retail offers is in high demand. And so that's where the institutional investors are now interested in, a lot more in retail.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because it did come up during our conversation when we met at ICSC a couple of months ago. So what is the reason you think that's driving that renewed interest from institutional investors right now in retail?
Well, they're really seeing the trends that we saw. So in 2019, pre-COVID, Amazon, really the best barometer for pure e-commerce sales, their sales growth had dropped below 10%. So it dropped to single digits. And so it was flatlining. I mean, not flatlining, but the growth had slowed dramatically. Well, 2020 hit, COVID hits, and e-commerce explodes again because we're all at home. 21, e-commerce came back down. In 22, it did too. But meanwhile, retail sales overall were going up because of revenge spending, because of inflation. And so bricks and mortar were getting an outsized proportion of that. So now Amazon's earnings just came out last week, their quarterly and year-end earnings. And I want to say that their online store sales only grew by about 8%. And then when you look at like where they're really making money, it's the cloud services, it's their advertising. And once you strip that out, they actually lose money, as we all know. I mean, that's not saying anything surprising, but it's a barometer for e-commerce. And so when you start looking at the future, the retailers know that they have to open bricks and mortar stores in order to be profitable. So not only is there growth in sales, but there's demand from the retailers to open more stores. On the other side, there's been very little new supply coming on board for the last decade, and especially over the last 4 or 5 years. And so there's this increase in demand, limited supply. So it's driving up rents. It's, reducing occupancy, reducing vacancy, increasing occupancy. And so it's just retail is now just in a solid position. So that's where the institutional capital is looking at all their metrics and seeing where they want to place their capital. And they're seeing the growth in retail as a potential for that capital placement.
What do you think is the future of the interaction between these different channels? Because clearly people like to be able to shop online. But right. It's also become even more clear in the last few years that they probably like to get out and go to their centers even more than that and go shopping and restaurants, movies, whatever, all the things people like to do. So how do you see the intersection of these channels and the interaction of the channels going forward?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. Because like I said, I joined the company 26 years ago, at the time as Pogo McEwen. And my dad and Terry always had this philosophy of focusing on the customer, the consumer, and their experience. And so that was the origin of the Lifestyle Center. Like my dad didn't want to go to the malls where my brothers and I were hanging out. And he wanted to create a unique environment where people could get out of their cars and spend time with their neighbors. And so restaurants were always a key component of our Lifestyle Centers. Well, that's just become more important over time, because at the beginning, this is well before e-commerce. I mean, a lot of the retailers were driving the experience. I mean, we would put up a billboard that would have named Coach, Anthropologie, and J. Crew. Well, now those brands are ubiquitous and they're still strong brands, but they're not as precious as they were pre-e-commerce, because people can go online, they're all over the country. And so now our branding has shifted into more experience. And so we'll show kids playing in a fountain or an ice skating rink or a family sitting by a fire or an event that we have. And so it's just we're catering and we've adapted to the experience. And that's where it's just like everything we've done for the past 26 years has been focused on experience. And that continues to be. And so that experience has just changed and evolved.
As many of our listeners already know, and as you referred to a moment ago, your company is a pioneer in retail, in the retail industry, and particularly in the creation of open air retail centers. Just to follow up on a couple of those points, as I understand it, that the firm's predecessor, the current firm's original predecessor was founded about 40 years ago by your dad, Dan Pogue, and his partner, Terry McEwen. And the first example of a lifestyle center in the United States was developed by them. It was, as I understand it, the Shops at Saddle Creek in Germantown, Tennessee. Is that right? And that's credited as being the first true lifestyle center ever in the United States, right?
Yeah. Well, we like to add the caveat, the first intentional lifestyle center, because there are projects like Highland Park Village in Dallas or Country Club Plaza in Kansas City, which were either street retail or grocery anchor centers that evolved into lifestyle centers. But Saddle Creek was the first intentionally developed lifestyle center in the country, opening in 87. And since then, we've bought, last year, we bought Somerset Square in Glastonbury, Connecticut, which, when I looked up the date, opened about 6 months after Saddle Creek. So it was like two ideas going on at the same time. But it's, Saddle Creek was the first one to open in 1987. And like I said, it was my dad and Terry's answer to the mall. And it was, you can imagine, like, it didn't have any department stores, and they they evolved the concept of having the tenants be their the co-tenants and drive the traffic, because these national brands were coming to Memphis for the first time, the Memphis area. Germantown is a suburb of Memphis. And so it was just a unique environment, but they didn't just want to do a strip center. And so that's where they did courtyards and fountains and better hardscaping and better landscaping and great architecture to try to capture that customer and offer a better, higher class environment for the retailers. And so from there, it's a concept that exploded. And I say exploded, it took 10 years for them to develop their first three. But then in the late 90s to 2008, the GFC, that's when the lifestyle center concept really just exploded around the country.
Would you mind giving us a couple more examples of the properties that Pogue has been involved with over the years? Because it may very well be that some of our audience members have one of your properties in their neighborhood, in their backyard. Any particular examples or even just innovations, you know, interesting milestones that the company has achieved in the last 40 years or so?
Yeah. No, I mean, a couple of just interesting tidbits and stories. So my dad and Terry's second lifestyle center was One Pacific Place in Omaha. And up until about a year ago, I had never been to Omaha. And so I'd never seen that project, even though it was part of our legacy, because they sold it before I joined the company. And so about a year ago, we were exploring the Omaha market, and we have ended up working with the local group, and we're developing a new lifestyle center in Omaha and called Avenue One. And so we're partnering with the local landowner. We're working through entitlements, approvals, leasing. And so we hope to start construction maybe later this year. We're moving forward on this. And as far as I know, it's the only lifestyle center that's being developed in the country right now. So it's history repeats itself, like from 40 years ago when my dad and Terry developed One Pacific Place. And now we're working on a new lifestyle center that'll be about 10 miles away from that.
Yeah, it really sounds like an example of what goes around comes around.
Yep. Well, and so here's the interesting part about it is that, so One Pacific Place was developed in the U shape of a strip center. I think it's about 90,000 square feet. So it's not a large lifestyle center, anchored by Trader Joe's. Parking is in the front. And that was lifestyle 1.0. Great architecture, landscape and landscaping, et cetera. But it was still the U shape of the strip center because that was my dad's background. The strip centers are very efficient for people parking in the front of the stores and walking right in. Well, in the early 2000s, in 2004, we opened our first Main Street style lifestyle center where we had the retail on both sides of the street. And it was just shocking because we still had parking in front of the stores, but then we had the balance of the parking on the outside, and it created a much more intimate environment. And this is a project up in Connecticut, Hartford, Connecticut, called Evergreen Walk. Well, flash forward, people around the country started evolving that into mixed-use vertical lifestyle centers, which we call Lifestyle 3.0. And so Lifestyle 3.0 is still typically a main street, so it's more dense, but then you may have residential or office above it. And so that's where the lifestyle centers over the last decade have really been focused on that vertical mixed-use development. And so that's what we're trying to bring to all of our projects. So I'll tell you, Avenue One is going to be mostly 90% retail, maybe some office in it. But then the second phase is anticipated to be more of a high density mixed use project. And we just had so much demand from retailers in phase one that we decided to focus on the retail of that right now. And also what I mean, the multifamily markets are not extremely hot right now. They have been over the last 15 years, but that's slowed down. So as we talked about a minute ago.
Let's fast forward, if we could, to 2022, which was a milestone year, another milestone year for the company. And just to bring us up to date, by that time, after some evolution, the company's was known as Pogue Shopping Centers. Is that correct? And the decision was made to take a very important strategic step that year. Could you tell our audience a little bit about that? About that particular decision and why it was made?
Yeah. So in early 22 or maybe even late 21, JLL approached us about potentially buying our company. And I immediately said, no, wasn't interested in that. I had talked to people about that historically and just it wasn't something that I was interested in. But in continuing talks with Greg Maloney, who was then president of JLL Retail Property Management, he came up with some interesting ideas. Effectively, JLL is focused on, and being a public company, they're focused on their earnings. And so they love the management leasing business. And because it's a steady income stream, what they don't love was the development, because in high times like 2019, development was great. They were accumulating fees. But then in 2020, when COVID hit, everybody stopped their development. And so it's hard to be a developer in a public company. But meanwhile, that's my lifeblood. Like, I've been developing a lifestyle center since I joined the company in 98, and it's my passion. So that's where we started figuring out the strategic partnership with JLL, where we subcontracted out our management and leasing to them, and they subcontracted out their development in the retail property management portfolio to us. And so it's been incredible, because one, on the management side, I mean, JLL has incredible systems and processes and a great team that has taken over the management. But I'll say the leasing has been just as important and even probably more important. And the reason why is that, as I mentioned earlier, leasing has evolved. When we were doing centers in the, say, early 2000s, we would call it Gap, because Gap had Gap, Banana Republic, Gap Kids, Gap Body, Old Navy. I mean, I'm sure I'm missing another Gap concept or two. Then we call it the Limited, and it would be Limited, Limited Express, Victoria's Secret, Bath & Body Works, White Barn Candle, Galleons, Abercrombie & Fitch, Hollister, Structure. I mean, it was just like a slew of brands. And so with those two calls, if you could get them on board, you'd have half your center leased. And then the other half, we would call up, I mean, Chico's, White House Black Market, Ann Taylor, Loft. I mean, just Coldwater Creek at the time. Just we called up all these companies, and it was all national leasing where we had deep relationships there. Well, as things have evolved over the last 25 years, as I've mentioned, a lot of our leasing today or food, fitness, entertainment. I mean, food drives brand because we have a lot of locally driven chefs and franchises, and restaurant spending, dining spending has increased dramatically over the past 10 years. And even especially post-COVID, because once people got out of their houses, they were looking for that experience. And then fitness has exploded too, because not everybody wants to go and get a drink with somebody or spend a large amount of money on a dinner. And so it's a new social activity. New. I mean, it's been around for a long time, obviously, but people are looking at these fitness users as a way to do yoga in the morning with a friend to catch up with them, or to go to SoulCycle in the afternoon and you interact with other people. And then entertainment everywhere from, I mean, your standard entertainment, like Main Event, Dave and Buster's, to movie theaters, to your smaller entertainment venues, which is heavily focused on pickleball right now. But they're just different trends in entertainment because everybody is looking to be connected again. And so that evolution of leasing, you need a lot more people on the ground. And that's where JLL provides what I call the infinite bench. I mean, they have so many brokers and so many people working on the retail property management and leasing side that when we're looking at a project in some far off city, it would have been really difficult for me as a small company to figure out how to lease that without hiring somebody in that city. Well, now JLL has people in all these cities all over the country. And so being able to tap into that local network is extremely important. And it's important for knowledge. It's important for leasing because leasing has evolved from purely those national chains into a lot more local leasing. And I mean, I'd say that like probably 10 years ago, 90% of our leasing was national. And I'd say today it's probably closer to 30%. So it's not gone away, but it's just it's shifted dramatically over the last decade. And so that's where the partnership with JLL has been extremely important as we've evolved and been able to tap into their greater network. And so it's been an incredible relationship, incredible partnership with them. And we're now close to a year and a half into it. And we're strategically working and figuring out what the next steps are to help both sides grow. And that's where we're both motivated for us to help them grow with more management leasing contracts. They're motivated to help us grow with more development, more ideas, more connections, networking, et cetera. So it's been incredible.
It sounds like it's a really exciting time all the way around.
Yeah. It's something I didn't even think about until Greg Maloney approached me. But once he started talking to me about it, it really hit home. And so he's since retired. But the team that's there now that I work with, I mean, Kristen Miller and Paul Chase, I mean, they have a good team all the way around. And so that's where it's like the head may have retired, but the body is just as strong.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, Josh, but right now is the focus in your shop primarily pure play retail or a mixed use or some combination of the two, depending on the market and the location and what the local market needs?
Yeah, I think most of what we're going to be doing is going to be some form of mixed use. And so we don't really have that expertise in-house. But once again, we can tap into JLL for that expertise. And we're not afraid to joint venture with other partners, whether that's an office developer or a residential developer. But we're really focusing on things that need TLC. I mean, they if it's straight down the middle, like it's probably not right for us. We want things that need to be redeveloped or ground up development, as I mentioned, Avenue One in Omaha. We just bought our first mall in Oak Court Mall in Memphis. We closed in mid-December. And so we're right now exploring. Great demographics, great location within the Memphis area. And we're examining now what we want to do with it. And so the thought is that the mall has seen its better days and it's deteriorated over time. And so that's where we're starting a public process to meet with Memphians and the local neighborhoods and the community to figure out what do they want here? Do they still want it to be a mall, which is doubtful, but you never know. That's what we need to figure out. Do we need to demolish it and develop a lifestyle center, mixed use project? Do they want more apartments? Do they want single family homes? It's just, we're going on that. We're just starting that process now, but we're looking at, right now we're in the process of potentially acquiring two more malls, that we hope close in the next 90 days in similar circumstances. Like they may not be, it may not be a redevelopment in the next year, but it's potentially a redevelopment of these properties in the next 5 to 10 years. And we'll explore what they, what the, what the vision is for each project individually. And that's where I think that a lot of these will involve retail, definitely will involve retail. I think they'll involve potentially some residential, maybe even some office. And so that's where we will likely focus on mixed use development.
It's kind of interesting that the first mall that the company has acquired is actually, it sounds like it's in your backyard, basically, since you're headquartered in Memphis. That being the case, is there some advantage to the idea that this particular property, as the first mall as such that you've acquired, is kind of in your backyard?
Yeah, I mean, it's so these other two malls that I mentioned that we're in the process of acquiring, they hit our radar screen before this mall in Memphis, Oak Court. Sure. But I've been keeping an eye on this mall for 10 years. It was a Simon Mall that they put into Washington Prime back in 2014 or 15. And we had actually looked at potentially acquiring it in 2011 or 12, and it didn't work. And so it's just something I've been monitoring and keeping an eye on. And it eventually was foreclosed last February, and right around a year ago. And so that's where I was like, okay, now is a time to strike. And so that's where we went through the process, won the bid, and acquired them all. So it just did. It ended up being a lot faster than these other two that were in the process of acquiring. But yeah, it's kind of ironic that you're exactly right. And this mall was built within a year of Saddle Creek, the original mm-hmm. lifestyle center. They're about 10 miles away from each other, but it's just funny that, yeah, we're back in our backyard.
Yeah. I'd like to hear more about your own personal journey in the business. You've been president and CEO of Pogue since 2014. And for 5 years before that, you were president and CEO of the predecessor company, Pogue and McEwen, if my chronology is, understanding of the chronology is correct there.
Correct.
And you've been held a lot of other senior positions, but well before that, of course. And like quite a few other executives, you've got some exposure to the industry through the family business. But I still have to ask, was retail real estate always necessarily on the radar? I was really intrigued to find out that you graduated from Princeton with a degree in chemical engineering. And I have to say, that's not the kind of college major that you would expect to see every day with the CEO of a major real estate investor and developer. How did you happen to come to study chemical engineering, and was the business, you know, necessarily always a direction that you were headed?
So great question. I have to chuckle because I did a presentation, not a presentation, a group meeting with like 20 college students a couple months ago. And that was like the same question, like, because you had finance majors, you had engineers, and they're like, how did you end up in real estate? And so I'll tell you, like, when I was in college, I had no idea that I was going to be getting into real estate. Like, I mean, honestly, like, growing up, my dad was a real estate developer. I didn't really understand what that meant. And I knew, like, it was involving shopping centers, and Saddle Creek opened when I was maybe an eighth grader. And so I understood a little bit about what my dad did, but never really focused on the details because he was my dad. That's what old people do.
Right.
And so when I went to college, I loved chemistry, but I didn't want to be a chemistry major because I wanted to create. I wanted like applied science. So that's where I went into chemical engineering. And so I did that for 4 years. Then after I graduated, I got a job in a manufacturing plant, a plastics manufacturing plant, as a plant engineer. And after about a year and a half of that, I was like, you know what? I'm not loving being an engineer. And I was also living in rural Indiana. And so as a young single guy, it was not the place for me to be. And so I moved back to Memphis. I got a job with a small merchant bank doing as a financial analyst. And so I did that for another year and a half or so. And as when I came back to Memphis, And just like as a 23-year-old, I started having lunch on a regular basis with my dad. And so I started picking his brain out, what do you do? And I started understanding more about development and what he was working on. And I'd say after about a year and a half, I'm like, Dad, this is actually really interesting, like that you're a developer and I'm interested in this because it goes back to being an engineer. I like to see things created. And so when he was creating a lifestyle center, it wasn't just like creating a shopping center on the ground. I mean, that part is filling too, but it was creating an experience for the neighborhoods and the region around him. And he always took pride that like inevitably he would open one of their lifestyle centers and it would be on the front page of the newspaper. It would be on the front page of the home show. Like, and it was a way for the neighborhoods to sell homes and offices in the neighborhoods. And so I started seeing what he was doing was that he was creating that third environment because, like I said, at the time, like downtowns were really, I mean, weren't hot. Like malls were for teenagers. There weren't a lot of places for adults to go and have an experience to find stuff that they enjoyed. And so that's what he started creating. And it was a place for families. And so that's where we started creating restaurant clusters and we put in amphitheaters and we put in lakes and man ponds and I mean lake is probably too strong a word, but ponds and features that really encourage people to get out of their neighborhoods and come to the lifestyle centers to congregate. And so it fed my need to create, and then it fed also my social desire to improve people's lives and improve communities. And so that's where I approached him and interviewed with Terry McEwen and joined the company in '98, 3 years after college, and worked for Terry for the first few years in the leasing environment, but then started evolving through the different areas of the business. And then 2009, Terry retired, and we had bought him out in 2007. I call him the smartest guy in real estate because we bought him out right before the GFC. But he finally retired in 2009, and so that's when I stepped into the president and CEO role, and at Bogan McEwen. And eventually, we got to the point where, with Terry retiring and no longer being in the company, we were like, you know, this kind of feels like Scrooge and Morley from Christmas Carol, is that his name was on the door. And eventually we're like, we need to rename it just Pogue Shopping Centers. And so that's where we've evolved from there.
You know, one of the many takeaways from your account just now of your career path is that sometimes I think that young people place a little bit too much stock in the connection between what they major in school and the path that they ultimately wind up taking. Is that something that you have found as well? And also, are there any aspects of studying what you did that you think you have been able to apply that training as a chemical engineer to your work, not necessarily even directly, but just in the way that you analyze things, that you look at situations, that you think about business that may not be a direct connection, but just in terms of the way that you were trained to think about things in your studies?
And so when I was presenting to that group of college students a couple months ago, that was the whole part of the conversation, was that I have three daughters that are 18, 16, and 13. And so I see this in them, but it's also like talking to others out there is that kids are putting so much pressure on themselves. They think that the decisions they make at 18 are what they got to do for the rest of their lives. And no, I mean, like if you go to college, you can change majors. If your college doesn't work, you can switch colleges. Once you're out of college, go and do a job. But if it's not fulfilling your passion or you just don't like it, you can change. Like the decision making, these are all like seniors in college. They were looking at jobs for next year and they were afraid of making the wrong misstep. And I'm like, no, because it's not like what you're doing at 22, you have to do at 25 or 30 or 40 or 50. You're not stuck there for the rest of your life. And And I've thought about this, and of all my friends from college, from high school, I could only come up with one example of somebody that is still doing the same thing now that they were doing at 22. And that's because this is a friend of mine that wanted to be a contractor when he was growing up. He became a contractor at 22, and he's still a contractor today. And so he chose that that narrative for himself. But everybody else has changed jobs, changed industries. I mean, like I did. And so, yeah, there's a lot of pressure out there. So my oldest daughter is a senior in high school. So she's trying to figure out her college experience next year. Yeah. And same thing is that she's putting on a lot of pressure to herself of like, okay, if I choose this, what's going to happen? And it's like, you start like building up this anxiety for what's going to happen down the road. And I'm just like, it's not the end of the world. You're going to have a great experience everywhere. And so it's easy to say that from my perspective. But I'll say like the second part of that question, like what are the learnings from college, is one of the main reasons I chose Princeton was it's a liberal arts education. And so I was looking at some schools where it's like, if I was going to be an engineer, that's all I would take, science and engineering courses. And at Princeton, I think I had 38 courses. And I think that if I remember right, 20 were in my major and the other 18 were liberal arts. And so I had some of the best English professors ever, some of the best history, some of the, like, I mean, a master's in economics that I was able to take these courses. And so that liberal arts education was really what I focused on is, yes, I'm a chemical engineer by major, but it's about like creating a broad mind. And my mind has always been really focused on logic, on numbers. And so that is what I've continued to do. So I'm heavily financed now, and in the finance side and the pro formas and the underwriting and stuff like that, understanding those details while also being able to see the big picture and create vision for the future. So it's like that liberal arts education, I think, was a great balance for me.
So really good perspectives to have, and especially for young people who are coming up today and looking to the future, for sure. Well, Josh, now we turn to one of my favorite sections of Investment Matters, which we call CEOs Off the Clock. You know, none of us can work 24/7, although it sure seems like we try sometimes. So could I ask you, do you have any particular ways that you like to recharge the batteries when it's time to finally take a break from the daily grind?
Yeah, that's another great question. So, I mean, first and foremost, with three teenage daughters, I love spending time with them. And that may be playing games, that may be going out and doing something around Memphis, it may be watching a movie with them. But that's my favorite, like spending time with them, spending time with my wife. Our best times are family time. And so that's where I make sure that's my first priority, first and foremost. But as far as personal hobbies, I'll tell you, my two favorite are reading. I mean, I love reading books. And I try to mix it up between science fiction and biographies or history. But I love absorbing books. And the other thing that I've gotten back into, and this kind of taps into what I was just talking about, like what I'm obsessed with, is that when I was a kid, I was a large baseball card collector. I was obsessed with baseball. And so I would memorize stats, and I had favorite players and favorite teams. And this is before the internet, so I couldn't just watch it all on TV, but I would get the sports section every morning and look up the stats of who went 3 for 5 or who had a pitching duel or whatever. I mean, it was like, I was obsessed with baseball cards and went away for it for a long time. And then kind of like stereotypically during COVID, I started digging out my baseball cards from my childhood and started getting back into baseball cards. And now my passion is basketball because of the Grizzlies being here in Memphis. But I've gotten back into basketball and baseball cards and spending time there. So it's just harkening back to my childhood, I guess.
Well, Josh Pogue, I really appreciate you taking the time to visit with us today and sharing your insights on retail, real estate, and so much else. It's nice having you here, and I appreciate your time.
All right. No, appreciate it, Paul. It's great to talk to you again, and I will see you soon.
That is my conversation with Josh Pogue, the CEO of Pogue Development Group. Please join me next time for another conversation with a leading commercial real estate investment executive. You can find archived episodes of Investment Matters and more CPE podcasts on Apple Podcasts and on our website, commercialsearch.com. Before you go, let me take a moment to tell you about an exciting opportunity. The CPE Executive Council is a group of industry leaders who exchange ideas about trending real estate issues. Highlights of their discussions are posted on our website and featured in our newsletters. If you're interested in joining the council, please contact CPE's Editor-in-Chief, Jessica Feer, at jessica.feer@cpe-mhn.com. Again, that's jessica.feer@cpe-mhn.com. Until next time, thanks for listening and be well.